Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, a conversation about Safe Streets, a program that enlists street-smart felons and reformed gang members to fight the epidemic of gun violence in some of Baltimore's most dangerous neighborhoods. Advocates of the program say it's dramatically reduced violent crime in the four communities it's operating in. We'll find out how the violence interrupters are getting young people to stop shooting and start living, and how the program is giving the men and women it employs a chance to have a positive impact in their communities. Dr. Daniel Webster is a professor who studies and teaches about gun violence and prevention at Johns Hopkins. J.T. Timpson is a community liaison officer with Safe Streets. They join me in the studio to talk about making Baltimore streets safe streets. Midday, coming right up after these headlines. And how you doing, everybody? I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're joining us today for Midday. Today, we're going to have a conversation about the Safe Streets program here in Baltimore. The concept was inspired by a similar program in Chicago. Folks fight gun violence by using insights of former felons, reformed gang members, and victims of gun violence. Community outreach workers known as violence interrupters walk some of the most dangerous streets in Baltimore, interacting with residents and stepping in to mediate tense situations before they escalate to violence. Their motto is "Stop shooting, start living." The program was launched in 2007 in McKeldry Park on the east side and Cherry Hill in South Baltimore. It has since expanded to Park Heights and Sandtown Winchester. In 2015, violence interrupters mediated nearly 700 conflicts, 80% of which were deemed likely or very likely to have resulted in gun violence. Researchers say those mediations have brought homicides down significantly in the participating neighborhoods. So while advocates contend that the program is uniquely positioned to curb the epidemic of gun violence in Baltimore, not everyone is convinced that the Safe Streets approach is effective. In July of this year, guns, heroin, and cocaine were found in the McKeldry Park Safe Streets office, and activities there were temporarily suspended. In August, Governor Hogan cut $1 million from the program as part of a package of $80 million in budget cuts. Half of that money has since been restored, and the remaining funds are being provided by federal and private grants. Daniel Webster is a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as the director of both the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and the Johns Hopkins Baltimore Collaborative for Violence Reduction. He's also the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, which partners with Safe Streets. And in addition, Professor Webster is the co-chair of the Safe Streets Advisory Board. Daniel Webster, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
James, J.T. Timpson is a community liaison officer for Safe Streets, and prior to taking that role, he was the Park Heights Renaissance site director. Mr. Timpson, good to have you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Dante Barksdale joins us as well. He's an outreach coordinator with Safe Streets. Mr. Barksdale, good to see you as well.
Same here. Good morning.
Good afternoon. So, Danny Webster, the statistics in Baltimore are pretty compelling. I mean, you've been studying this now for a long time. You issued a report a couple of years ago. Give us a general overview of the efficacy of this particular approach.
Sure. So the first program site was launched in McKeldry Park back in the summer of 2007. We've had various sites over, you know, since that time period. And what we do is try to study to see whether the program areas where the program is implemented has different trends in both non-fatal shootings and homicides. We found in prior studies, and we're about to come out with a new one we'll be coming out with very shortly, that there is a fairly consistent correlation between the program and there being fewer shootings. There, some sites have more consistent success over that time span than others, and I think that's important to learn. This is a program that we've found when it's really clicking, when it's really working well, can have very dramatic reductions in homicides. But we've also had sites that have struggled with implementation issues. And we have to acknowledge that this is a challenging program. When you think about the complexity and difficulty of a problem like gun violence, and while I think this is a great program model to get people who are closest to this problem to mediate disputes, to try to change norms and sort of serve as a bridge from where people are to more healthy, safer lifestyles, we have to acknowledge that this is never going to be a perfect science. It's not always going to go well. You have humans involved. Some are better at this than others, and we're learning as we go.
And J.T. Timpson, who are the ones who are successful at this? The folks that are doing these interventions, give us a general general description of the kind of personalities they have and what makes them successful.
I think the biggest part of the job that we do is relational. It's building relationships. So the people who are most successful at doing the street work, the street level mediations and things like that, are those who are trusted within the community. They're trusted for different reasons. Again, we hire guys who have had a reputation in the community from previous things that they've done, probably on the wrong side of the fence. And now that they're, have been rehabilitated or reforming and changing, now they use that same credibility or same relationships that they had with the community to try to drive down the gun violence and connect with those who are most likely to be victims or perpetrators of the gun violence in the community. So I think it's really about trust and relationships.
So at the heart of this is credibility on the street, credibility with the folks who are living in these neighborhoods, who are dealing with the kind of constant violence that we're also aware of in certain neighborhoods in our city.
Absolutely. Credibility looks different to the culture that we deal with based on the law-abiding culture. So the difference is that a lot of, it's kind of the Robin Hood mentality. The guy in the community who might have been viewed as a problem because he was a drug dealer, but that might have been the same guy who was providing book bags and shoes for the kids when it was time to go back to school. You know what I mean? So it's like, to a law-abiding community, he's still not a good person. To a neighborhood that's struggling and in poverty, it's kind of looked at a little bit differently. You know, they looked at more credible. They looked at as a trusting person. So Credibility is what really makes the difference in this program.
So, Dante Barksdale, I'm told that you have a particular knack, a particular skill in identifying, and I'm told, by the way, by these two other guys, by Webster and Timpson, a big part of your job as a coordinator here with Safe Streets is that you're looking for those folks who have the kind of background that JT is talking about, but could possibly be convinced that they can turn that background into a positive. So what do you look for? When you have that first conversation with somebody who's maybe been out of prison now for a little while, what's that first conversation like?
So, we've put a couple of things in place, to combat relapse and stuff like that. But what you're really looking for is a guy. So when we go out into the neighbor, I actually do a canvas with them. So, when I get a referral from the current team or someone that I know or something like that from that neighborhood, what I do is I tend to walk them through the neighborhood. So if we walk them through the neighborhood, you can actually get a sense of what this guy's about or any kind of activity that he's involved in. So we're really looking for guys that with strong reputations, where if I walk through a neighborhood, it's older folks speaking to him, it's clergy speaking to him. It's community members, little kids, everybody is saying, hey, what's up, man? You see that he has this relationship with the community. Now, we also know that it's guys that fit the criteria but don't have the personable skills to be a violence interrupter or an outreach worker. Let's just take, for instance, now myself. I tell people all the time that a guy could probably get away with calling me a bitch, saying something crazy to me now. At this stage of my life, because I understand who I am, and the person who's out here mediating these conflicts has to have a good understanding about where they are in their life and how they're going to actually react to certain situations. You have guys that sometimes say, bump that Safe Street stuff. I'm not trying to hear that. But you have to know that you have to be consistent. You have to have that persona, that personality, to be maintained humble. And be, you know, persistent with the goal. And the goal is to reduce shootings and homicide, not to protect your character at the time, because that's not what we're looking for. Our ultimate goal is to reduce shootings and homicide. So we need guys that are strong and they understand who they are, you know, and these are the kind of guys that I look for. They have to be strength, have that strength and be credible in the neighborhood.
And let me ask, how old are you?
I'm 42 years old.
All right. So was that something that you think you could develop when you were 25 years old, that you could have that? I mean, doesn't age have something to do with it? I mean, we all get older. We all get a little smarter, we hope, you
Definitely.
Know, a little more mature. I mean, Daniel Webster, the pressure that these interrupters are under seems to me to be enormous. I mean, they're going because they're talking to folks at a moment in time where tensions are high, and the possibility of this thing going south is always really good. Yeah. You know, I mean, they're these are unarmed guys walking into situations where the folks that, with whom they're dealing are armed, and they're young people too, right? We're not talking about 60-year-olds going around the neighborhood, are we?
No, I think Dante put it very well, of sort of the type of person you're going to look for to do this. This is, there's a lot of programs, you know, that are well designed, have some evidence that they reduce violence, and depend a little less upon having the perfect person to do this. I think mm-hmm. this is a particular intervention model that there's only so many people who are cut out to do it, and it's great to have someone like Dante, who's been with the program since its inception in 2007, to know what it takes. And, you know, there's a little bit of, frankly, some trial and error, and these are all human. So the individuals who have that sort of street cred, they have stressors of their own lives that we have to help manage. So that one of the things that we've been talking about recently is, what do we do to support the violence interrupters, knowing the great stress that they're under? And one thing that I've heard more than a few times is that they may have a particular work schedule, but they live in those communities. Yep. And their work is almost never done. When something is going down, people will reach out to them. They are trusted individuals. And so that's an enormous.
And that could be 1 o'clock in the morning.
Anytime.
2 o'clock Sunday afternoon.
Anytime. And I have enormous respect for law enforcement officers and what they do to keep our communities safe. More often than not, they are going home to a different place with a little cushion, right? People generally aren't knocking on their door when something's going down if they're not on. But the Safe Streets workers, they're on almost all the time. So I think it's incumbent upon us to think about, how do we support these special individuals, the stress they're under, and the important things they do to keep people from getting shot.
Mm-hmm. And J.D. Timpson, I mean, these guys, and they're mostly guys. I mean, do you have many women doing this?
Yeah, we have one female interrupter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what is the total citywide now with the four locations? How many interrupters does Safe Streets employ?
So total is 33 staff mm-hmm. through all the sites.
And what is the age generally? What, I mean, how old are these guys mostly who are doing this? I mean, because you're targeting the population you're dealing with are very young. I mean, mm-hmm. they're 14 years old up to in their mid 20s, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, who has the credibility with those? Is it fellow 23-year-olds, or is it guys that are, you know, look, man, I'm 40 years old. I've been where you could end up, you know. I mean, how does that dynamic play out?
It's the OGs. Well. The originals, that they the ones who have the credibility. So, because you got to remember, the streets have changed so much that it's not a lot of guys gaining credibility out there in the streets like guys did back in the day. You know, the credibility, that the way guys gained credibility back in the day was way more stand up than it is today.
And back in the day is how long ago?
I mean,
at least 25, 30 years.
90s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, excuse me, most of our interrupters are probably in their mid 30s, late 30s, early 40s. You know what I mean? I think we had a few young ones, but, you know, everybody has a unique skill set. So there are some young ones who, and that's when I say young, in their early 20s or mid to early 20s, that are able to reach that population that's in the 14, 15-year-old range.
Yeah, and what an interesting challenge that the streets are changing, that the things are not the same as they were. I mean, your name, Barksdale, is a name been made famous, you know, by The Wire and stuff. I mean, it's not like the 90s. It's not like The Wire anymore in a lot of ways. Interesting. Daniel Webster is a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He studies the prevention of gun violence and gun policy. Professor Webster is also the co-chair of the Safe Streets Advisory Board. J.T. Timpson is here as well. He's a community liaison officer with the Safe Streets program. And Dante Barksdale joins me in the studio here. He's an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Safe Streets, on this approach, on its efficacy, on its value to the community. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, if you want to join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back in a little bit. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the broadcast, it's our monthly Smart Nutrition Show. Nutrition diva Monica Reinagle and Chef Andy Thomas of the Elephant Restaurant. They're going to stop by to share tips on how to entertain and eat healthy during the holiday season. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about Safe Streets, a program that addresses the epidemic of violence in communities of color here in Baltimore by employing former felons, reformed gang members, and victims of gun violence to mediate situations on the street before they escalate to violence. I'm joined in the studio by J.T. Timpson. He's a community liaison officer for Safe Streets. Prior to taking that role, he was the Park Heights Renaissance site director. Dante Barksdale is here as well. He's an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets. And Daniel Webster, he's a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He serves as the director of both the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and the Johns Hopkins Baltimore Collaborative for Violence Reduction. He's also the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, which partners with Safe Streets. And as if he has nothing else to do but go to even more meetings, he's the co-chair of the Safe Streets Advisory Board. We'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. Our email address is midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle is @MiddayTomHall. Daniel Webster, the data that we have about this, is it based, this is a program that's based on a thing called Ceasefire that started in Chicago. It was an epidemiologist, a physician, who said this is an epidemic of violence. We need to address it the way any epidemic, like, you know, the flu or something else is addressed. We've got Chicago as a model. We now have, you know, several years of data from Baltimore. Are there other like programs around the country? What is the body of data? How much do we know?
Sure. Yes. This program is in place in a number of cities in the United States, and actually it's now an international program. They are going to I forget the number of countries that they're in, but a number of countries, a very challenging set of circumstances. There's only a handful of studies, however, that have been published on this. And generally, you know, I would say good positive outcomes, but as sort of as I was alluding to earlier, in the case of our experience in Baltimore, we have had some sites that have not been successful. So we have to acknowledge that. And it really comes down to sort of how do you then interpret if you generally have a successful outcome, but sometimes not, what do you take away from that? I take away from it is that this is an effective model that we need to be very vigilant that we get it right, that we get the right people, the right oversight, and then finally the right supports. I think it's unfair simply to say, okay, let's get these guys and it's all on their shoulders. We really, as communities and as a city, need to support this program to be effective because they have demonstrated in a number of cases in some of the most challenged neighbors that they can reduce homicides and shootings. So what I'm hoping for is that we get full support for this program, and I think that's when we'll see the more consistent benefits that reach more neighborhoods in Baltimore.
So, J.T. Timpson, I mean, you've got your eye on all four sites that we have. So we have Cherry Hill, Mondawmin, McKeldry Park, and Park Heights, right?
Well, there were actually five sites. Mondawmin site is shut down now for reorganization, hopefully to come back online in the new year.
So Mondawmin is one of those ones that Daniel's talking about didn't quite work out. I mean, there have been some problems.
Yeah, we had to, based on the data, we had to take a step back and really look at how to really make it work.
Whereas like Cherry Hill in South Baltimore seems to have been pretty successful, right, by all metrics. So what do you think is the difference? I mean, what makes Cherry Hill succeed and Mondawmin have some at very least, growing pains?
Each neighborhood is kind of different. Like, the dynamics of the neighborhoods are different.
Right.
I can say that I could talk about what I know from firsthand experience in Park Heights. When I was the site director at Park Heights, one of the things that I knew coming in was that we had to really take a step back and look at, number one, employment for the guys that we were dealing with, and not really employment just for them, but we had to kind of look at employment or eliminating barriers for their whole support structure. So that's the, you know, maybe mom, dad, brother, sister, you know, we kind of had to deal with not just the individuals, but their whole support network to kind of bridge some of these gaps. So I know employment was a big focus for us when I started at Park Heights. And I made that an emphasis for, you know, my violence prevention coordinator, who's the person who's responsible on the staff for finding resources for the family members and the participants that we deal with.
But I would imagine that employment is an issue in all the places. I mean, Samtown,
absolutely,
certainly employment is an issue. Park Heights, you know, Cherry Hill. I mean, it is interesting. But every neighborhood is different, Dante, isn't it? I mean, and maybe the level of understanding you have on the street is going to be better in some places than others. Is that true as well?
Yeah, pretty much. You got to say that, because I mean, even talking about Cherry Hill, one of the things that JT forgot to mention is, like, if you look at Cherry Hill, it's like an island. It's like, if you're going to Cherry Hill, you're going to Cherry Hill.
It's more close-knit.
You know, it's like, so.
Yeah, it's kind of isolated.
Yeah, the people
folks
there.
Folks can go cruise in and out of Sandtown.
Right. Because
it's easy to get to. Cherry Hill, you got
to
be wanting to go there.
You're going to Cherry Hill. You know, and the difference is, looking at McElderry Park, you know, Alsace Street's office is on Monument Street. It's a strip mall. It's Johns Hopkins Hospital. It's people coming in and out of the area all the time. It's a transient area. It's like Mondawmin is, you know. So we know that, you know, we got to be more alert in these areas. You know, our violence interrupters even got to watch cars going by to, you know, recognize guys in certain cars that are from certain other neighborhoods and things like that. But as looking at Cherry Hill, that's not going to happen too much because, you know, people know you don't want to go into Cherry Hill and go down the hill. You might get stuck.
Yeah.
You know, so that's the difference. So that's why I believe that Cherry Hill was able to quell more of the violence than other areas, because those people are from Cherry Hill.
Right.
If you go.
And every place is different. Yeah.
Every place is
410-662-8780 is our number here on Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phone. Sonia in Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, I just want to simply say that my community in Better Waverly had some issues with young men on the corner. It had been ongoing for years, and I became so frustrated as one of the directors of the board that I looked up and I saw my Dante Barksdale, who I'd known for so many years, and I called him and I said, Dante, I know you do the Safe Streets thing. Can you please, please come in and talk to the young men, to the community, to see how we can get a better understanding? Not only did he come, but he brought JT with him. He brought the lovely Deidre Lane. He brought Anisha. And they sat with us on their own time. And they helped us reach an understanding. I simply want to comment that Safe Streets bridged the gap for us in Better Waverly, where we thought it was something big. We realized it was just a lack of communication. They did it on their time. They are the true link between the police and the community. I think it should be worldwide, but we'll start in Baltimore. Dante, I want to publicly thank you, JT, Deidre, Anisha, because it was just like a manna from heaven when they stepped in and helped a community that couldn't resolve an issue and made us realize that all we needed to do was sit down and talk to each other. And I just will thank you all forever for what you did for us.
Great.
In Better Waverly.
Well, thank you, Sonia.
Thank you, Ms. Stone. Yeah.
Thank you for your call, and thank you for the work that you're doing up in Greater Waverly. I mean, Danny Webster, scaling this program up, you know, extending it past just the four or five neighborhoods that have, you know, previously had it, that's going to take a lot, isn't it?
It is going to take a lot. So
it's not just money either.
You're absolutely correct. So part of it is resources. Part of it is a management structure to support it. And I think looking forward, we need to be thinking about how do we strengthen the community-based organizations that employ the workers directly. Most people know this program as a program overseen by the Baltimore City Health Department, which is. But the actual workers themselves are hired by local community-based organizations. And so we need to think about how do we support those organizations directly in better ways so that they get better outcomes from this program. They get the right people, the right oversight, and the right supports. Mm-hmm.
Daniel Webster from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're also joined here in the studio by Dante Barksdale and J.T. Timpson, who are working with the Safe Streets program. Let's go to Burrell in Baltimore. Burrell, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Yes, how you doing, sir? First of all, I'd like to say thank you to all the gentlemen that's outreaching and helping the people in the area. I was a Baltimore City police officer 15 years, done a lot of youth programs, done a lot of work with different organizations in the schools, churches, everything like that. And what I'm wondering now is that I took a step away from the police department. How can I help an organization like you? How can I use my skills that I acquired over these years and bring it to an organization like yours and work with somebody?
Well, thanks for that question. I bet there are a bunch of folks listening that have that same question, Burrell. Thanks for your call. So, JT, the police in particular is a very interesting dimension of this program because, as a matter of fact, the police can be among your biggest critics in that you purposely don't share information with police because if you did that, the downside is that you would lose all credibility with the folks who are talking to people on the street.
Absolutely.
So that's a tension there. I mean, how do you reckon that?
We realize that there's definitely a job for law enforcement to do out there. We realize that and we respect that. But there's also a community at large that we tend to deal with a little bit better just because of our relationships with them. So the biggest thing or the myth, the biggest rumor that we want to dispel is that we discourage people from calling the police or, you know, anything like that. No, that's if you're a law-abiding citizen and somebody commits a crime, you have every right to call the police. The problem is it's this big snitching culture where people have gotten the definition of what it is confused. It's not the law-abiding citizen who calls the police on somebody committing a crime. That's not a snitch. You know, what we confuse it with is those who are actually out there committing crimes themselves and then calling the police on other people committing crimes. Well, you should have a little more dilemma there because, you know, something's really not right.
Facebook, it's complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated. Yeah. So we definitely understand and respect the job that law enforcement has to do, but we also have a job to do out there as well.
I mean, are there opportunities for folks like Burrell who want to be involved, who want to help? I guess this maybe goes back to what Daniel was saying about strengthening the community organizations, that kind of thing.
Yeah, trying to get with Daniel and get on the advisory board and try to advise, you know, some of the work, you know, bring his resources, bring all the stuff that he said he learned and, you know, the experience that he got for the last 15 years and, come on, bring it. We need it.
So I'll just jump in very quickly here. The individuals that they're working with and they're trying in the immediate sense to try to make sure they're not shooting each other. Of course, that's the most basic. But beyond that, they're trying to, again, build some bridges to opportunities. And I think that there are important roles in the communities to connect these individuals with. And that's my hope for the program is that as a city and a set of communities and neighborhoods, we come together and support these Safe Streets workers because they can't do everything for the individuals that they're working with. They can try to get their attitude right. They can try to calm them down. They try to promote social norms, but they need linked to other people in the community that can support them a variety of ways with job opportunities, housing, other sorts of things that they need. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's tons of needs here. Mm-hmm. There's only a special group of individuals can do that street level mediation kind of work, mm-hmm. but there's all kinds of other things that ideally should support what the program's trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like Ms. Sonia said, we the buffer. You know, if I go to a little guy on the street and I knows that he needs a job, he needs ID, he has, you know, a dirty urine, stuff like that. If I have the resources to help him, then it could be a soft hand on. I could walk with him through the process because what? I can see myself in that young man. You know what I'm saying? So this is what we have to do. We have to walk with them gentlemen. We need to bring those resources to them. Because it's sad to say, but there are some other barriers that stop these kids from getting resources. Certain neighborhoods they're afraid to go to. Certain neighborhoods they did things when they lived there and they moved because they did things there and they can't go back there. So we need to assess all of these kinds of things when we're working with these young men. So when I'm working with a young man, if I know that he can't go over to the church on Lafayette Avenue for our turnaround Tuesdays, because he used to live over there and he may have been a prosecuting witness or shot somebody, I'm not sending him there. So I got to be conscious of these things. Like, well, where have you been? What have you done? And that's the relationship that the VIs have with the community. We know the situations that the young guy been in. I can look at it, assess, and say, okay, all right, this is how I can help you. You don't need to go over there because that's where you shot that guy or you got shot mm-hmm. or you stole something or you did something. And I can help him with that. And help him internalize what it, exactly the situation that he in and how we're going to help him and stay away from all those barriers, man. It's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. It's tough. So the complexity of this is just tough. Astounding.
We need one-stop shops for IDs, Social Security cards, and birth certificates. Mm-hmm. That's a rough thing for a young man who needs an ID to get a job. And then sometimes guys get jobs, and the jobs say, well, you got a week or two to get your ID, or we're going to have to let you go. Mm-hmm. And then it don't happen.
So, Danny Webster, I know that there's some aspirations in some programs around the country to actually certify the VIs, the violence interrupters, and to give them a sort of, you know, professional certification the way a therapist has, sure. which would include patient-therapist confidentiality, so that it would address this notion of, you know, cooperation with the police and that stuff, but would also, with that kind of thing, also then grease the wheel to let folks like Dante and JT, you know, be able to assist people, you know, in these very real ways in immediately.
Well, they definitely do receive a lot of training, these guys. You know, some of this is on the job kind of training as well, but they do receive a lot of training and they should be trained and supported and viewed as professionals. Mm-hmm. These are skilled individuals. They have unique skills. We need to support their education and professional development and
And, you know, we use the term first responders to talk about police and fire officials, people, the folks that are working at Safe Streets are in very many ways first responders, are they not?
Yeah, absolutely.
They're there before, the police.
I could give you another example. The unrest last year, it started right at Rice's Town and Gwynn's Falls. At the time,
El Mondawmin
site is up and running. Now, you know from traveling through Baltimore, from Gwynn's Falls and Rice's Town all the way to CVS, we're talking about 30 businesses, both sides of the streets. Well, our interrupters were standing on Rice's Town Road. And after those kids threw those rocks and did whatever they want, our interrupters just kept telling them kindly, keep take it past Clifton. Y'all in our sight. Mm-hmm. Don't hit none of these stores. And our guys were there to help the Mondawmin area. You know, so these are the kinds of things that the outreach workers can do.
Let's see if we can grab one more phone call before we take a break. Richard in Cockeysville, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
It's good to be with you. I'm glad to have the opportunity. Real quickly, in Richmond, California, a few years ago, I got a new police chief, and they identified 17 individuals who were responsible for most of the, I guess it was serious violence in town. It wasn't homicides, but serious violence. They put him under contract, brought him in, paid him money,
mm-hmm.
and treated them respectfully, mm-hmm. and crime went way down in Richmond, yes. California. I yeah. don't know if that's still the yeah, case. I don't know if we've case. Looked at doing something like that in Baltimore. That's my question.
Yeah, well, you got a big amen corner going yeah, on
it's,
here.
It's called the Richmond model.
It's called the Richmond model. It's a little bit more complex than that because you even took it even takes guys who are having a conflict with one another, and like they have to do a thing like where they have to ride on an airplane together. Share a room out of the country or in the state together, and then post it on social media. So both crews will know that the two guys that are having conflicts are becoming friends now. And then what does it happen? It translates to, yeah. because these guys are who? The OGs, the guys that people listen to. So right. once he has a change of heart and a change of mind, then that manifests.
It goes through the rest
the
of the folks in the gang and then the clique. And it's
down.
All right, well, we got lots more to talk about, and we will do that when we come back. J.T. Timpson is the Community Liaison Officer for Safe Streets Program. Daniel Webster is a Professor of Health Policy Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dante Barksdale is an Outreach Coordinator for Safe Streets. Want to hear from you, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. Very glad you're with us on this rainy Tuesday here in Baltimore. If you're just joining us, we're talking about Safe Streets, a program that addresses the epidemic of violence in communities of color here in Baltimore. Daniel Webster is a professor of health policy management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as the director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research. J.T. Timpson is a community liaison officer with Safe Streets, and Dante Barksdale is an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Daniel Webster, the economic impact of a program like this needs to be discussed. There are, as of today, there have been 286 homicides in the city of Baltimore, and people are half patting themselves on the back because it hasn't gotten quite to 300, which is, you know, what we greatly exceeded last year. Mm-hmm. But in addition to the homicides, there were 700 shootings so far. Shootings are expensive. I mean, if a person dies, it's a tragedy. And if a person is shot and disabled for the rest of his or her life, that is also a tragedy, and in a lot of ways a more expensive tragedy than an actual death. What's the economic impact, and what does the data say about the economic impact of programs like Medicaid, for example?
Yeah, it's really tremendous. It's difficult to break all the different components down because the cost, there are acute costs that hit hospitals, doctors, and all of that component. But then for some victims, there's lifelong disabilities. And so you have a very broad range of what these costs look like. The other most hidden cost of shootings actually is the fear within communities that depress property values, depress business and economic advancement. It's been estimated that each shooting, if you would count all the different kinds of cost, is about $1 million of social costs. That you add up all the medical, the community costs, the law enforcement and disability, about $1 million on average for every shooting. So when you have a program that is effective in reducing shootings, and my latest research indicates that on average, the Safe Streets program reduces shootings by about 27%. It's very clear that it's a cost-effective strategy. The difficulty in sort of promoting that, making it sort of obvious that this is in our self-interest to invest in, is those costs are spread out through all different institutions, and we need to, I think, now we have a new president who's not so fond of the Affordable Care Act, but there can and should be incentives for hospitals to invest in these programs, because a lot of people, those gunshot wounds that they treat may not be insured, or they're hitting state costs and others' costs. So.
And JT Timpson, do I understand it correctly that sometimes you send some of your violence interrupters into hospitals? I mean, if someone's been shot, there's the potential for retribution because mm-hmm. of that crime, because of that incident. You're actually talking to folks when they're like literally in their bed getting better from a violent incident. So is there a potential to expand the kind of cooperation you're currently enjoying with hospitals?
So yeah, we actually have. We just received a grant to launch what we call the hospital responder component to the model that will be partnering with Johns Hopkins Hospital to launch that component of the model, where we will actually hire violence interrupters who work specifically in the hospital for the gunshot victims that come into that particular ER. We also have a relationship with Sana, where we're also going to be doing the same thing with Sana, where we're going to be hiring some violence interrupters that will specifically work in the ED for those who come in with gunshot wounds or whatever. We look at part one crimes, but for this one, we'll have to kind of scale it back because both of them see so many emergency patients.
So, Dante Barksdale, give me an example of a dispute that you or some of your violence interrupters have mediated and overcome.
I was sitting here thinking the whole time, right? And I almost forgot which mediation I was telling you about. So can y'all like brief me on which one I was talking about? Because I thought
you were talking about a kid who was related to you. During the break, you were talking about a kid who was at the Palladium and he was related to you.
Okay, it was a kid. He wasn't related to me. He was related to a buddy of mine. So I was at the Mondawmin site. While I was at the Mondawmin site, I heard about the conflict that took place at the Palladium. So my guy, his name is Noah. I'll keep it like that. I won't say his nickname because everyone will know. He has a son who had a whole bunch of lead paint poisoning money. So his girlfriend...
Well, he got a settlement for lead paint.
Got a settlement for lead paint. So he's at the Palladium. He sees his child's mother engaged with another guy. They get into a dispute. He tells the guy that he's going to put $20,000 worth of money on his head to get him killed for messing with his baby's mom. So just so happened while I'm at the Mondawmin site, I hear the name. And I say, hold up. I know that little guy. I said, that's my dude's son. So she said, yeah, that's what I was trying to tell you about. The mediation that I had up at the Palladium, one of them little dudes over east said he was going to put $20,000 on the little kid here. But just so happened the little guy is a rapper. So his producer, when I get to the Mondawmin site with the VI, the producer and the little guy who's supposed to be getting killed, I called Fat Man's father, Noah, over. When he got there, the producer and Fat Man knew one another. And we were able to mediate the conflict. So this goes back to what JT talked about, relationship. Had I not been there to have an ear about the conflict that was happening.
There's plenty of serendipity in this, too. I mean, it's kind of luck that you happen to hear about it, right?
It was just pure luck for me just standing there. So this was a cross-town mediation because one set of these guys were from Monument Street and the other set of guys were from White Lodge.
So east side, west side, that's a whole other universe,
east,
right?
Whole other universe. Yeah. But luckily I had Cheese there, and Cheese was a super violence interrupt if I have Mondawmin site.
An SVI.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. Danny Webster, is there obviously gangs and the rise of gangs, the popularity of gangs among young people, the efficacy of gangs to recruit young people at very tender times in their lives are a big challenge and a big part of the reason that there's so much violence. Is there any data that's suggesting that Safe Streets is putting a dent in that, that in terms of gang recruitment, in terms of, cliques and gangs being able to attract young people, are there interrupters who are able to say, take another look at that choice?
That is not something we have studied directly. And honestly, I think the program model isn't exactly head on to address what you just raised. It does I do want to take the opportunity, though, to say, in addition to reducing shootings, we've been able to do on-street interviews with youth in neighborhoods where the program is going on versus comparison neighborhoods that don't have the program. And in two separate studies shown that it affects attitudes and social norms around violence in the way that you would want to. So when you present them with a variety of scenarios of whether they think that's an appropriate thing to respond with a gun or not, where there's safe streets, we find much less acceptance for that. So they're doing their job not only in just mediating the disputes, they're doing their job in changing social norms. And that's very, very encouraging if you change those norms.
Yeah. JT, when a thing like the incident in McKeldry Park in the Safe Streets office there happened, and mm-hmm. I misspoke at the top of the program. I said it was July of this year. It was July of last year. So mm-hmm. this is like 4 months after the uprising. It was in that climate. We were in a situation where the crime around the city was spiking, including in McKeldry Park. I mean, is McKeldry Park considered, fixed? Is it considered a failure that's, getting itself together now? Is it considered a success? Where does that sit in the panoply of the four sites that you have now?
So, no, McKeldry Park is fine. It's back up and running.
And I think, if I'm correct, none of the people who were originally arrested in that were charged with a crime, ultimately.
Absolutely. All the charges were eventually dropped. So what we know is that we took the opportunity to take a look at some different things about the program that really hadn't been addressed. Mm-hmm. So one of the things we needed to focus on was the relapse issue and how do we really address it? What safeguards can we put in place? So we looked at the period of time in which somebody should be released from prison before they actually can be eligible to be hired for staff.
Mm-hmm. So you're waiting a little longer now than you used to?
We require like two years now.
2 years.
2 years. And during that 2 years, they need to have been doing something within the community that we can go back and tangibly say that, yes, this person has been a part of this community and doing X, Y, Z. Yeah. And that could be something like volunteering with the site.
Yeah.
They could volunteer with the site for a while. I had a guy in Park Heights who actually volunteered for the site for 2 years, and now he's a violence interrupter there. Mm-hmm. We look for those type of individuals now. We also, as part of our hiring panel, to go back to what we talked about a little bit earlier as far as the police is concerned, part of the hiring panel is that we include the police department in on the hiring panel for when we hire our outreach workers or violence interrupters. Mm-hmm. Police department, faith-based community, the health department, mm-hmm. community members, maybe sometimes Dr. Webster.
Trying to get as many folks to get some buy-in as possible.
Yeah. As much buy-in as possible.
Right. Well, we got to call it quits there, but I very much appreciate the work that you gentlemen are doing and also appreciate your taking the time to be here today to talk about it. Thank you so much. Thanks for having us. Daniel Webster is a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He serves as the director of both the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research and the Johns Hopkins Baltimore Collaborative for Violence Reduction. He's also the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, which partners with Safe Streets, and he's the co-chair of the Safe Streets Advisory Board. James J.T. Timpson is a community liaison officer for the Safe Streets program. Prior to taking that role, he was the Park Heights Renaissance Site Director, and we'll have more information about Safe Streets on our website, wipr.org/midday. I'm also grateful to Dante Barksdale, who's joined us as well. He's an outreach coordinator for Safe Streets. Thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests today. Joe Squared serves cold-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours can be found at joesquared.com. That'll do it for us today here on Midday. Coming up tomorrow, it's Smart Nutrition with the nutrition diva Monica Reinagel and Chef Andy Thomas from the Elephant Restaurant in Baltimore. We'll talk about how to entertain and enjoy all of those holiday feasts and parties without packing on the extra pounds. That's Smart Nutrition tomorrow on Midday. We'll see you then. I'm Tom Hall for the entire Midday team. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.